Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Ellen Brown is on today. Ellen, of course, is a civil litigation attorney, a distinguished author, a frequent writer on financial issues, a frequent guest on this program. I always mention her Web of Debt. Ellen has a forthcoming book on public banking. I can't wait to see it and read it and discuss it on this program. And Ellen will be holding a public banking conference on the 2nd to the 4th of June. Last time I thought it was coming up imminently later in April. I got my dates wrong, but it will be in June. It'll be in California. And certainly a very crucial issue will be discussed, public banking. And Ellen has another article that will be forthcoming. Unless you change the title, Ellen, you call it Bailout is Out. Bail, you got a little bit of a tongue twister. Bail In is In, another argument for publicly owned banks. Oh, there are so many arguments, Ellen. I'll just say this. We've talked about this on the program before. If listeners in America think their bank accounts are safe because FDIC insurance covers the amount they have as long as it doesn't exceed the maximum amount that gets coverage, you better think again, because no bank account is safe. You put your money in the bank owns it. You don't anymore. How about that? I didn't know that until I read a previous article that Ellen wrote. The bank owns your money. All you get in return is an IOU. Well, an IOU might not be worth the paper it's written on. Certainly the government, the FDIC, isn't going to do you any good. There isn't enough money in the FDIC to bail out any one of the big banks, even a lot of much smaller banks. So you think they're going to bail out ordinary people? They are not. So we've got this wretched bail-in scheme. It started in Cyprus. It's spreading like a cancer. It's moving to Europe. It's moving to Canada. It's moving to America. What an argument for public banking, Ellen. I'll let you take over.
I agree. Public banks are really the only safe possibility. You really do need the government behind you. Even people then write to me and they say, well, what is safe? Where should I put my money? What about credit unions? What about the stock market, et cetera? The stock market, well, I know about my own broker, which is Scottrade. I called them and asked, and they said they do these overnight sweeps. So any money that's in the money market account, you know, the money you've got in your stock, obviously you just own the stock. You don't actually own any money there. But so any cash you might have in the stock market would be, say you sold a stock and then you're waiting for a nut to buy another one. So it's just sitting there. That money goes into an overnight sweep into one of the too big to fail banks. So they could easily, in fact, they practically always go bankrupt overnight or over a weekend. So it would be when they've got this huge pool of funds. And the same, the credit unions use these big correspondent banks, which are the too big to fail banks. The whole thing is hooked into this big web that where they can reach many things and bring many things down if they go down. And so that's the whole point of these bail-in policies is they're not going to be able to, like you said, the FDIC is not going to be able to afford to bail out a huge derivatives bust of, say, J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, which are the two big ones. They've got $79 billion and $75 billion, respectively, in derivatives.
You mean
and
trillion?
They each have over
trillion.
A trillion. Trillion, and they each have over $1 trillion in deposits. So, they're a derivatives bust could take all the deposits. What the real problem is that derivatives are first in line in bankruptcy. You would think the depositors would be first in line because it's their money, but they're not. The derivatives claimants are considered secured claimants because they have to put some money up in order to bet. You know, that's the way derivatives work. And public banks are considered secured because they require the big bank to put up collateral in order to back their deposits. But the derivatives go before all of that. So even our government monies could get wiped out in a big J.P. Morgan or Bank of America bust. And it's not covered by The government won't step in. They've said that in Dodd-Frank. They specifically said that most derivatives won't be covered. They basically said, you boys can continue playing your derivatives games. We're just not going to bail you out next time you get in trouble. So what those big banks have done is to move their derivatives books into their depository arms. And they did it, like Bank of America did it specifically when they were in trouble. In 2011, they moved all their derivatives over into, that was from Merrill Lynch, they moved it over into their depository banking arm where everybody has, a, you know, their bank account with Bank of America. So that money could easily get wiped out. It all just goes into a great big pool, and then the claimants rush in and snatch the collateral when there's a bankruptcy.
Ellen, it is really shocking, the stuff that's going on. We're big banks that literally operate under a model of grand theft. They do anything they want, and these derivatives are the most risky of all types of investments, and they have multi-trillion dollars of this stuff. Sooner or later, you're going to see stuff go sour. But the banks don't have to worry about that. They do the things that you're talking about, and we move from bailouts to bail-ins. Ordinary people are the ones that get socked. So you see this financial war going on. I remember Warren Buffett, who certainly is not one of my heroes, calling derivatives financial weapons of mass destruction. Well, he left the most important thing unexplained, that the destruction is taking place on us, or would take place on us if the banks get in trouble. It certainly won't have any effect on the banks, because they'll just make us bear the pain for these abuses, these casino abuses that the big banks committed based on their grand theft policy. You know, anything goes, along with manipulating the markets and all the kinds of things that go on. And this is the financial side of things, financial war in humanity, and you get so much more. I've written so many articles on the erosion of freedoms in America. So we're losing our financial freedoms, Ellen. We're losing the constitutional freedoms, to say nothing about financial freedoms. One thing after another. I wonder how many people, I'll just shift gears a little bit. I wonder how many people really understand what happened in Boston during my hometown, the place I grew up in, during the period when the city was on lockdown. It literally was martial law. The Constitution was suspended. You had militarized police and jackboots on the street, armored personnel carriers, helicopters hovering overhead. You had FBI SWAT teams. You had Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives operatives on the streets. You had drug enforcement agents out. There were probably other federal, state, and local enforcers on the streets. I mean, this was the face of full-blown tyranny. So you got financial... financial tyranny on the one hand, you've got the other kind of tyranny on the other hand, you've got wars going on nonstop overseas, and people were literally rousted out of their homes in Boston, Ellen, families that had nothing to do with anything that went on, in their pajamas. Some of them were handcuffed, they were put face down on the street. If anybody resisted, they probably would have been arrested. They could have been shot and killed. This was in my hometown. It could come anywhere. So first they steal our money, Ellen, and then they steal our freedom. Well, not first. They're doing it at the same time. Does anybody understand this stuff? Well, I think listeners to this program understand, but too few people in America know what's going on. Let's go back to the financial stuff, Ellen, that you do so, so well.
Well, that is alarming. I don't know how conspiratorial we want to get, but it both the Sandy Hook and the Boston things look highly suspicious. I mean, it looks like a setup to make martial law seem normal. But the people cheered, you know, when they supposedly caught the killer. So people come to relate to these SWAT teams in the street, and they think, oh, good, we're being protected, rather than rebelling, pulling out their own guns, which is, you know, what the whole freedom, the right to bear arms is supposed to be all about, to protect our Constitution. And anyway, to prevent us from doing that, we're supposed to relate to this militarized city that we see around us by these various events. I don't know, it just all looks highly suspicious to me. I mean, I read all those, I can't resist reading all those emails I get. There's so much so much that just doesn't jive in both of those stories.
Oh, well, I've written a lot about what happened in Boston and so much more, Ellen. There's no question that the official story is so full of holes, it absolutely doesn't wash. But, you know, I mean, you erode one freedom, you move to another, it just becomes universal. You lock down Boston, you can lock down any U.S. city, you can lock down the whole country. You have a bail-in in Cyprus, you can move it to Europe, you can move it to Canada, you can move it to America, you can move it anywhere. They can steal our money and they do it with impunity. And This is the kind of ugliness going on. It's getting to be the new normal, Ellen. I mean, if ordinary people don't understand this and realize that the freedom you think you have might disappear overnight, and when you wake up in the morning, what you thought existed yesterday will be something entirely different today, and unless people do something about it, well, the freedoms we think we have in America are going gone.
Yeah, agreed. And the whole, well, on the banking side, preserving it's all about preserving these too big to fail banks. Well, the whole collapse was because of these too big to fail banks. They would have failed but for the fact that the government stepped in. So now they're saying, all right, the government's not going to step in anymore, so we're going to have to take the deposits because that's the only way we can save the too big to fail banks. But it isn't the only way. There's some other alternatives. One, you could nationalize the too big to fail banks. It seems to me crystal clear. If we, the people, one way or another, either with our tax dollars or with our deposits, which is even worse because if you happen to be a depositor in Bank of America, when it goes down, you lose all your money. It's not just a tax on your money. If we're going to support these big structures, if an argument is to be made that they do such important things internationally that you have to have these giants, and I can see that argument. I've heard reputable people say that they just do too many things internationally, and if you break them down, then the foreign international banks will be doing all that business and will be dependent on their too big to fail banks. But assuming that they're too big to fail and that we have to have such structures, we should own them. When they fail, which they will, we should step in and say, fine, you boys are out. We own this property, and we're just net out the derivatives, just like they did in Iceland, just walk away and say, we're not going to pay it. And then operate the thing in the public interest. I was just writing about Ecuador's central bank. Ecuador owns their their oil company. The government owns the oil company. They use those oil revenues to back their bank, and they use the bank then to do development in the country. I mean, what a concept that we should actually allow the government to own something and actually make some money and use that money for the benefit of our own country, for our own development, and for our own people. There's so many solutions that you could do if you just had some, you know, honest people in there that weren't paid off by banks. And not that I think Congress people necessarily aren't honest. I think they're stuck because they have to be paid. They have to accept that funding from the corporate world, or they won't get reelected, or they won't, you know, they don't have the machine behind them.
It really begins, I don't know where it begins, Ellen, but certainly on the U.S. electoral system, it is a hopeless system. I agree with you, there is no possibility you can get a legitimate government under a two-party system that really reflects two sides of the same coin. There virtually is no difference between either party today. There was a difference way, way back, but it ended at least a couple of decades ago. It was eroding slowly, probably beginning in the 1970s, and then it eroded much more over time, so there's no difference today. But they're beholden to the campaign contributions they get. Well, there are some countries that have a very short electoral cycle. It maybe runs a few weeks. Big corporations don't contribute. There are no massive TV campaigns and the rest of it. I mean, this is what America needs. It needs to open up the system to anybody, to multiple parties, and everybody gets in on a level playing field. You need to get away from these political contributions. You need a whole different electoral system to begin with. Otherwise, we're going to perpetuate the kind of government government we have today, and it doesn't matter. I mean, anybody can get into office. Nobody holds a high position in government or an appointed position unless they're part of the embedded power structure. But it's part of the whole system that's been set up. We literally need to rip it down and start over again, and then there's a chance to do some of these other things. But if we don't do that, we'll never get a public, we'll never get a federal public banking system. Gee, if we're lucky, Ellen, maybe we can crack a few more states.
Yeah, well, that's why we're, you know, our public banking institute, we're pushing for state, local, county banks because you actually can do something there. I think probably the closest is in Pennsylvania. There's a group working there. And in Pennsylvania, first of all, they're desperate, of course. They're Philadelphia is completely broke. Their school system is broke. But in a small county in Philadelphia, you get a couple of people over lunch, and you can make a decision. I mean, they're run by a handful of commissioners. So it's not like you have to persuade 300 people that are all backed by big banks. And it, a public bank is actually does serve the local banks. It's good for the local banks. And once you convince them of that, it seems to me our only hope is we can't really battle Congress or what's going on in Wall Street, et cetera. What we have to do is set up another mousetrap, you know, a better model, and then we just all move into it and say, fine, you do your thing, but we're going to bank over here, and we'll, I mean, that's kind of what Bitcoin is all about. People are, it's so popular because nobody trusts the regular system anymore, so they're just moving into another system. I think we need to have another banking system, publicly owned, publicly directed, serving the public.
Well, I certainly agree 100%, Ellen, and most people, the great majority of people in America, we can see what's gone on for a fair amount of time, especially in the new millennium, concentrated in the new millennium. The 1990s, we saw economic growth. There wasn't the kind of situation that's been going on for the last dozen years or so. It has really been horrific. You've got big corporations making lots of money. You've got super rich people in America making lots of money. The Bush tax cuts, 80 or 85, maybe even a greater percentage of the tax cuts went to people who already have too much. They don't need any more, but they're the beneficiaries of this. And tax cuts do not produce economic growth. Putting money in people's pockets is creating jobs. That's what grows the economy. And then you've got the official data really rigged. So it's manipulated just like the markets, Ellen. So the real inflation rate is around at least three times the reported rate. And unemployment is about 23%. It's not the 7.6, I think that was the last number. I mean, it's a phony number. They come up with these U3, U6, and so on and so forth. But they rigged the system to make things look better than they are. But if you just look at what's happening to ordinary people in their own lives, many, many millions of them, they are really going through hard times. And certainly the power of money has so much to do with it. The power of politics corrupted under an electoral system that doesn't work, and the power of money that's in the hands of big, powerful banks and other financial institutions. I mean, they do just fine for themselves, but they do it at the expense of everybody else. If we don't fix this, Ellen, it's going to worse and worse. You know, there'll be another downer. We'll go through another situation like in 2008. It might be worse than 2008, and then there'll be a recovery, and then there'll be more consolidation. Things will keep escalating bigger and bigger. I mean, we're heading for the ultimate of all balloons, where maybe the entire system will implode. But maybe before that, we'll have a war in the world. Instead of having a financial war on humanity, there'll be a hot war on humanity, and maybe we'll never get to the ultimate balloon blowing up. But who knows? Any way you look at it, the system we live under is absolutely dysfunctional and causing so much harm and so much misery to so many people. If we could only figure out a way to change our electoral system and our banking system, we would have a chance to really live in a decent world, Ellen. We might even get rid of all of these wars. I think we would get rid of wars. If you don't fund them, you don't fight them.
Yeah, totally. Well, and if you got rid of the military, you'd have all the money you needed for just about anything. I mean, a huge amount of money goes into wasteful or who knows what, even military stuff. We don't even get to know what they're doing with our money. I was on the electoral system. I was reading about in Russia. Of course, we don't necessarily want to have the same system as they do, but they have a one-party system. But what that means is, because it's all the same party, the parties aren't—they're not two big machines competing with each other, funded by money. It's actually individuals competing with each other. So they're all in the same party, and they have to prove that they're the best and that they're the best guy for the job, and that, you know, so they actually have to perform, and the better performers are the ones that get elected. So I thought that was, there are definitely ways you could set up a system that would be fair, equitable. I'm not saying that that's perfect, but I just thought that was an interesting point about their system. I think we need a system that starts at the bottom, so everybody meets and in some little community things and talks about their local issues, and then you get to know the people, and then you elect somebody to the next level up, you know, a person you know personally, and they all meet in some next level up body, and they all know each other and elect the best man for the job, and it goes up from there. So it's all people you know personally, rather than you just have a choice of two sort of faceless or nameless, or, so you know, puppets that are really just representing something rather than themselves having control. Even if they wanted to have control, they don't get control. Or, I mean, even if they were sharp enough to do the right thing, they don't actually get to. They either get bumped off if they try, or I suspect they take you in a little room and they say, "We've got your wife and kids here, and this is what you're going to do."
Actually, Russia has a number of parties, but there's one dominant one, Ellen. United Russia, I think it is, Vladimir Putin, his party, but some small parties exist, and they participate in the election, including the Communist Party. I can't remember them all. I wrote about them during Russian elections last year, presidential election, and then a parliamentary election. But I think it's United Russia that's the dominant one, and they could have a better system.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I meant China. I didn't mean Russia. Oh, that's interesting, though. Thanks. Yeah, it's China that just has the one party, I think.
China has a one-party system.
Yeah, that's what I was reading.
And Cuba, too. But the majority of people in Cuba support the system that Cuba has. It is not a repressive system. It's a system that is so much different than America. I mean, Castro did wonders in Cuba. If it wasn't for the embargo, Cuba would really be, could be an extraordinary country. And he's still around at age 86, or maybe even 87 by now. But Cuba is set up so that there's no possibility of going back, at least as far as they can control, no possibility to going back to the days when Batista ran the government and the mafia ran the government, and Cuba literally was a mafia state, a brothel. I mean, completely out of control. People were so grossly mistreated, and Castro wanted that not to happen again. So there is a one-party state in Cuba, but it mostly does the right things, and it wants to eliminate these forces that may want to bring it back. I'm not an expert on Cuba's political system and economy, but it really could be an extraordinary place if it weren't for the embargo that's caused so much harm for so many years since, around 1960. 1960 to now? It's amazing that Cuba is still standing. But it is. Anyway, that's another topic. And Venezuela, well, Venezuela, under Bolivarianism in Venezuela, been around since 1999. I certainly hope it has a very long shelf life, Ellen.
Yeah. And Argentina, I think, is getting a bad rap. They sort of defied the international bankers and just started, well, the women, you know, it's Cristina Kirchner and, or whatever her last name is. It's Kirchner's wife, anyway.
Yep.
And the head of their central bank is a woman, and the two of them are going back to old-fashioned greenback style government, where, well, Argentina, like for the last decade, first of all, they walked away from their debt when they were bankrupt, and it worked out. Everybody said it would be terrible for the country, and it worked out really well. And then they just started printing their own pesos because they didn't have a currency, because they, you know, when the currency collapsed, and that worked out really well just in the face of all these people that said it would be hyperinflationary. It wasn't. They just printed enough to have the money to make demand meet supply. In other words, enough money to go along with the potential productivity of the country. So they've got this decade of examples that the neoliberal policies that they had been pursuing for the previous decade, which totally wrecked the economy, didn't work. And so now they're doing their own thing. But there's, you know, there was rioting and it's blamed on the government that prices are going up. But it's the same deal where the government's being, the British and Americans are sort of boycotting, you know, they're cutting them off from their foreign trade and making it more difficult to get products. And so you can really screw up a country. Well, I'm sure we're doing that to Iran.
Absolutely, with very severe sanctions on Iran and the situation in Syria. And that's right, Argentina, a little bit of an outlier. Ecuador, a little bit of an outlier. Venezuela, a much bigger outlier. Independent countries that decide they want to operate their governments their way, and they get targeted. They're really targeted by America, Ellen, and then the other Western countries go along. I think other Western countries would like to have normal relations with Iran and Venezuela, Ecuador, the rest of them. And just imagine what's going on in Britain right now. Britain is a longtime U.S. ally. It's one of my members of my own personal axis of evil. I have my three countries that I would put in that category, with America leading it, and Britain is certainly there. And you get Julian Assange from WikiLeaks. He's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Oh my goodness, for months, maybe since the middle of last year. And I mean, imagine being there and not being able to go out, and Britain is spending millions of dollars guarding the embassy so that if he sets foot outside, they'll arrest him, they'll send him to Sweden on a bogus rape charge, absolutely phony, but the dirty game is get him there and then extradite him to Washington, where they want to put him in prison and do the same thing to him they're doing to Bradley Manning. For doing what? For releasing information. Well, we still have a First Amendment in the country, and none of it was super classified. It was stuff that a good investigative reporter might have gotten his or her hands on and published. Well, I guess they could put them in prison, too. They have gone after journalists in America. Obama is waging a war on whistleblowers. He's gone after a journalist. He's gone after Assange. And at the same time, let the criminal bankers do whatever they want. What a system, Ellen.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, my only hope is that we can get organized. It seems to me, if you look back historically, for one thing, we know this is going on. Like, if you look around in your neighborhood, most people are just going about their business. They have no conception of all this stuff. But the active internet is a buzz all the time. They're alert to everything. They're ready to pounce on any conspiracy or any, you know, anything that looks fishy. It comes up on the internet. So at least we've got access to information now. And if we could get organized, I think that's a major problem, is that people don't agree on the solution. But if we could get organized, it's always those populist movements that actually change governments. Like in New Zealand, there was a big, in the 1930s, the central bank was set up to be a Bank of England, Federal Reserve type bank, and there was a populist movement, and they took it over and used it for just to issue the credit that the country needed for development, instead of using it as a private bank that would sort of, you know, a private usury bank, as they say. They used it as a public credit generator for the country, and it worked really well. But it was a big popular movement that made the government do it. The government didn't really want to do it. It was because they had a lot of people behind it, and I think that's our only hope, is to get together and move together.
Ellen, I agree, and it was just a few years before Abraham Lincoln became president, 1860, I think it was, that the former Republican Party was formed. a brand-new party, a former Republican party, nothing like today. And a few years later, Lincoln became president. Ooh, we had a lousy war that followed. But we had Lincoln. We didn't have George Bush. We didn't have Obama. We need to take a break, Ellen. We'll do that brief one, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. Talking with Ellen Brown about public versus private banking, giant banks. Oh, on the subject of debt, Ellen, I believe that the national debt exceeds the GDP, and with all the money printing madness, we're adding more than a trillion more dollars every year. Confetti that instead of being dropped on Main Street, it's dropped on Wall Street, and you've explained so well in Web of Debt and in your other writing that if this kind of money creation were sent to Main Street, we could have a very prosperous economy. But if you simply give it to bankers, well, you know, they'll use it for big bonuses and salaries. They'll use it to buy up competition and get bigger. They'll use it for speculation. They'll do it for everything other than growing the economy and lifting all boats. Well, they don't care about all boats. They only care about their own. Well, they don't have boats. They have yachts. And ordinary people suffer. So we've got this debt issue, and we've got money going in the wrong places, Ellen. And again, you've done so much marvelous writing about all of this.
Well, the money that goes to the banks, the banks can't really use that. I mean, it's an asset swap. So the Fed prints money, buys up either mortgage-backed securities. I think they're buying $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities and $40 billion in government securities every month now. But what they do, so the Fed prints the money or creates the money on its books, buys the assets. So now in the Fed, into the bank's reserve account, on its asset side, it used to have assets of some sort, and now it sold the assets, and now it's got dollars. So it can buy other assets, but it can't actually. That's money it can lend. I mean, it's the asset side, you know, or those are the loans, money it can use to buy, like, securities. But it doesn't actually go out into the real economy. If they wanted it to go out into the real economy, that's what they should do, is allow the Fed to make loans to state and local governments. I think they desperately need it. It's the Fed's fault that they're bankrupt, it's the bank's fault that they're bankrupt, because the banks had the big banking crisis in 2008, and so everybody got laid off. They couldn't pay their taxes, or they pay less in the way of the taxes, so the governments just don't have the income they used to have. So lend them some interest-free loans, just as the banks get virtually interest-free credit, and they could do development-type things with it, hire people, et cetera. But apparently, when that was proposed to Ben Bernanke several years ago, when he was on QE2 then, he said, well, it's not in the Federal Reserve Act. He's not allowed to do that. So it's really Congress's fault. Congress needs to redo that act. But I think the problem largely is nobody really understands banking. Nobody understands derivatives. That's super priority status for derivatives is terrible. They should definitely do away with that. But because people don't understand derivatives, it's quite easy for the banks to say, oh no, if you get rid of that, if the derivatives go down, then it's, you know, this big house of cards, and they tend to hedge their bets, so they place a bet one way and the other way, and if they don't get paid on one of their bets, then they won't be able to pay off in the other bet, and so you'll have this great cascade of all the derivatives going down, and that will collapse the economy. But that's not actually true. That it's because derivatives now have super priority in bankruptcy that everybody wants to own the derivatives instead of owning the more secure, ordinary type of of debt. So you made you put a premium on this very risky thing because you give it special treatment. So you need to get rid of the special treatment. In other words, I'm not saying that very well, but.
Oh, we sure do. And if the banks get in trouble, it's very easy to have the, well, I guess it isn't easy because it isn't done, but it could be easy if we had people in Washington that decided to do it. Nationalize the banks, take them over. I don't honestly know whether it would be better to keep them big to go head-to-head with the European ones, Ellen, or other big banks, Japanese ones or whatever, but keep them big or break them up and keep them small, but take them over. This has been done. Other countries have nationalized their banks, and you can clean them up, you can run them, you can get things back in order again. You'll probably go through a couple of years of hard times, but this is what's happened in the past in countries, Argentina, in Sweden, it happened to, it's happened elsewhere, and you come out of this situation strong, and you grow again. The little I've written about Argentina, Ellen, where they went through a couple of very bad years after the new millennium, after their debacle around into the new millennium period, and once they regained their health, they had a very vibrant growth for a couple of years or more. They had the strongest economic growth in South America, and I haven't followed them since. I don't know what their growth was last year or what their growth looks like this year, but you can come out of the worst of times with the best of times if you just have good policies. But if you perpetuate these bad policies and the stuff that I've written about the Fed, Ellen, I mean, we've had, if you go back over the history of the Fed, 100 years as of December this year, over the Christmas holiday period, 1913. I mean, we've had, I forget the number, 16, 17, 18 recessions. So we had the Great Depression. We have this horrendous thing we're going through now. And I mean, and you just have this terrible cyclical up and down, up and down, up and down. If you had a responsible system, you could have money put into the economy for productive economic growth, as you explained in Web of Debt, and just the way it was in colonial America and other places, where this thing could literally go on, I don't know, but in perpetuity, but possibly back in colonial America, it went on for a generation. It was tax-free. I guess they had tariffs then, but there was no federal income tax. The economy grew, and whether everybody prospered, I don't know. It was a different world back then, but things turned out much better then than the way things have gone since the Federal Reserve came into existence. Why can't we have, and these were public banks. These were public banks. The colonies had their own banks, and they ran things the way they wanted to. In other words, the government had control of the money. The private bankers didn't have control of the money. Well, as you explained, Ellen, it worked. If it worked then, and if it worked in other places, it could work now. It's not a matter of size. It's a matter of good policy, and you understand that certainly a lot better than I do.
Yeah, well, no, I don't understand it better, but I'm just agreeing with you. It seems to me that our whole banking system is wrong. It's all based on borrowing. Like, the banks have to borrow the money before they can lend it. Well, in fact, they actually lend it first, and then they scramble around and have to find it. So either they take it from their depositors, or the reserves, you know, that go with the depositors' money, or they take it from, they can get deposits from other banks. That's called the Fed funds market, or they can get it from the money market or different places, and they pay variable interest rates. They can get it from the Fed itself at 0.75% if they can't get it anywhere else, but they try not to do that because it sort of, I guess it looks like the bank is in trouble. But they're always borrowing this money first. But if you go back to that original model in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania bank just created, well, the Pennsylvania government just created the money actually as these little paper receipts. And so the paper scrip, you know, which was the money, and then they lent it into the economy. And then, so what backed the receipt was actually the creditworthiness of the borrower, not the fact that that money had been borrowed from somewhere else. So right now you have all these banks that can go bankrupt because they've already they've taken your deposit, which they borrowed, and lent it to somebody else. I mean, even if you got rid of derivatives, you still have a problem. You still got the Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life problem, where he's lent all the money out to the homeowners, and it's, you know, Mr. Smith comes in and he says, well, I lent your money to Mr. Jones, and he'll pay it back in 30 years. So there just isn't enough money in the system, because they always have to balance their books and borrow it from somewhere else. But if you saw money as something else, as a monetization of people's promise to pay, or in other words, you turn a promissory note into something that they can spend in the economy at the local grocery store, then you have infinite money. You have as much money as you need in order to match the creditworthy borrowers who, you know, come to you, show you how they're going to pay it back, what their plan is, what their business model is, or whatever it takes to demonstrate to the public banker, who is just a civil servant doing his job. So you demonstrate to this civil servant that your IOU is good for it, and then you turn that IOU into money. Instead of, like, now normally, if you went into the grocery store and you said, Mr. Jones, you know me, you see my crops down the street, down the road, and you know that the crop's going to come in, and I'll pay you when the crop comes in. And the grocer would give him credit. But a stranger comes into the store and says, here's my IOU, and prints out a little piece of paper. The grocer's not going to take it because he doesn't know the stranger. So the stranger has to go into a bank and prove who he is, how he's going to pay it back, and the bank turns it into an IOU that is acceptable in the market and stands behind it, and that's what real banking is, it seems to me. But it has to be a public entity. You don't want to give a private entity the ability to create money, give it to whom they will and not to others, or give it to themselves, whatever. So that would be my model for how to redo the whole system.
Oh, if we could only make you Secretary of the Treasury, head of the Federal Reserve, Ellen. Again, I mean, these things that really work, I don't consider them rocket science, Ellen. The way you explained it in Web of Debt, it takes some knowledge to understand what works or what doesn't work, but it really isn't that complicated when you boil it down to the fundamentals. And it's been done before, and it does work. And if it has been so effective before, why can't it be again today? Well, we're talking about really reworking the whole U.S. system that I consider dysfunctional, and it's causing so much harm. I doubt I'll live long enough, Ellen, to see what I would imagine will probably happen at some point, where a system that simply doesn't work, you have these violent ups and downs, and terrible, terrible corrupt system run by big money, run the way America is run in most Western countries. And unless you can fix that, things will reach a point where the entire thing, I mean, you're literally building a house of cards. A guest that used to be a regular with me until he passed away, sadly, a year ago, last April, I think it was. I think that was the last time he came on the program, Bob Chapman. Oh, he was marvelous. He was a former insider, Ellen, and he really knew what was going on. And he basically said that over and over again. He couldn't predict exactly when the whole thing was going to come down, but he described the system as really a house of cards, and you perpetuate this dysfunctional system, and you can keep it going. You can kick the can down the road, but at some point, the longer you delay really changing it responsibly, the worse it'll be in the long run, and it'll really come down crashing very, very hard. I think he was right. I miss him so much, Ellen. He was wonderful just following him on a regular basis to see what he was saying about the state of things at the present time. But he's gone, and so I can only remember his words of wisdom that he repeated so often. And again, I don't think I'll live long enough to see it, but unless there's a way to fix this, and I doubt I'll see it in my lifetime, and I may not live long enough to see the whole system crash down, but probably I'll live long enough, Ellen, to see another great debacle, maybe worse than 2008, and ordinary people will suffer.
I think it is the end of a Ponzi scheme, and that's why they've done this outrageous thing of making it legal. Well, it is legal, but making it obvious that what they're planning to do is to actually take the depositors' deposits. They always did take the depositors' deposits. Like in the 19th century, when banks went bankrupt, the depositors just lost their money, and that's why you'd have all these runs on the banks, and that's why they finally set up the Federal Reserve, and that didn't work. They still had the biggest bank run ever in 1929, so it didn't stop the bleeding until they set up the FDIC in 1934, and that supposedly guaranteed deposits up to a certain limit. But there's no way that FDIC, well, the $25 billion that they have right now is certainly not going to cover a big bank derivatives bust. And supposedly the FDIC is funded by the member banks, and they're not going to be able to afford it either. Those are like the little banks. They were really crippled when they had to come up with $8 billion in, I think, 2009 or so. So what happens when they're going to when they have to come up with $500 billion or something in a big derivatives bust? So the big banks know that they can't get it out of the government anymore. The governments are balking. Iceland balked. In Dodd-Frank, they're balking and saying, we're not going to do this again. In the EU, they've got that ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, is supposedly going to be on the hook for bank bailouts. But they're balking there. That Dutch finance minister, whose name I can't pronounce, who after the Cyprus thing, he said, this is going to be the template in the future. We're not planning to use the ESM to bail out the banks. In other words, the governments, the Eurozone governments, which are on the hook for paying for that ESM rescue mechanism, we're not going to use that to bail out the banks after all. So the banks have no choice but to take their depositors' funds, like they always did before there was such a thing as depositor insurance, and then rely on the depositor insurance. And then if the government says, no, we're not going to pay, you know, we the governments are not going to be responsible for bailing out your deposit insurance either. Anyway, it seems to me it's the end of a huge Ponzi scheme, and this is an act of desperation on their part. So if on our part, it's an opportunity to see what they're up to see how outrageous it is. Matt Taibbi just came out with an article about not only have they manipulated the LIBOR rate, but they've manipulated all these interest rate swaps, which are, you know, I think $500 trillion worth or so. I mean, an unbelievable sum is on the line on those things, and they're manipulating. So it's becoming more and more obvious that the banks that are running the world are crooks.
Understatement, Ellen. Institutionalized grand theft. I think that explains it. A conspiracy between government and the major banks and financial institutions, and ordinary people like us get scammed. But you continue.
Well, it just seems to me, hopefully, as we become aware of this, that people will protest. We have our conference coming up in June 2nd to 4th, as you pointed out. And Matt Taibbi is our lead speaker on Sunday night, and he'll set it up by showing how corrupt the whole system is. So it's obvious we have to do something. And then we have some other really great speakers. We have Birgitte Donts.
I know Taibbi. I don't know the other person.
Birgitte is from Iceland. She
So we'll talk about the Icelandic situation.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
She was essential in mobilizing the people to object to going along with the bailout of the Iceland banks. So, and I would guess that might have been the trigger for these bail-in policies when it became obvious that countries were liable to follow Iceland and refused to bail out their banks. They had to come up with a new plan, and that was the new plan. So, yeah, and then, yeah, we have a great lineup of speakers, but hopefully we can generate lots of interest in getting organized around the whole idea of every city, county, state should have its own public bank. You need a safe place to put your money, not just personally, but you need a safe place for the local governments to put their money. Their money is going to get wiped out in a big bust too, even though they think, of course, they've got their deposits that are protected up to $250,000, but most, like, states can have billions of dollars in their deposit accounts. California does. And so that's not going to be covered by insurance. It's covered by the collaterals that they post, which are federal securities. But that collateral is going to be gone if the derivatives players have super priority. They'll snatch it right up. So the governments themselves need to protect themselves by setting up their own banks.
Well, it seems like crises these days, Ellen. The latest one is worse than the previous one. That's the pattern since, especially post 9/11. 2000 was the recession in 2000 was a rocky time. That seemed like a pretty big one. Stock market took a 50% hit. It was repeated during the 2008, early 2009 recession. There was a huge banking problem. We had the savings and loan crisis back in the 1980s. My God, it seemed like a garden party back then compared to what went on post 2007. And probably the next one will be worse than anything we've seen so far. So we see this stuff get progressively worse, but it isn't the people who caused the problems who are harmed. They see their profits drop for a year or so, and then they come bouncing back so strong. It's ordinary people who are harmed. We've got to figure out a way to change this, Ellen. If tiny Iceland can go up against the Western banking system and end up standing on its feet, then other countries can do the same thing. I remember Gordon Brown, whoever was the president of Iceland at the time, accusing him or her of basically a war on terror crime, an act of terror. I forget his words, but an act of terrorism for daring to stand up against the system. Well, you know, the Marines or the British Marines or whatever didn't march in. Nothing happened. Iceland mm-hmm. came out of it strong. It could happen to any country. Mm-hmm. I can only dream that it will happen, Ellen.
Yeah, I agree. I'd like to give our website for, in case anyone's interested in that conference. It's publicbankinginstitute.org, and it's got all the information. And then my regular website is webofdebt.com, and I've got over 200 articles. I'm sure you've beaten me in articles. You're way more prolific. But still, that's quite a few for 5 years, I think, in banking.
Oh, I've been doing it. Oh, my goodness, about 8 years I've been doing it. I began a little late in life at age 70.
I bet you have 2,000, right?
It's become an obsession. And I'll repeat the website again, Ellen, publicbankinginstitute.org. I think if anybody Googles Public Banking Institute, they'll come to your website. They could also Google your name, and they'll find it, and they'll find information. If anybody is interested in attending, Ellen would welcome you. It's a very, very important thing. Ellen, I wish we had more time. I'll just wrap it up and saying it's certainly it's one of the two biggest things I can think of, reforming the electoral system, reforming the America's money system. Literally, you fix those two, you could change the world. You could stop the wars. You could end the police state laws that are on the books. You could do wonders in the country. And what happens here could spread elsewhere. Ellen, I look forward to having you back again, and we'll certainly talk before the conference takes place, and we'll certainly talk after it takes place.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks, Ellen. And I'll just remind listeners, join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.